The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Sports Talk 1240, Sunday evening, June the 12th. We got a new show opening there, right, Brian?
It's new. I like it. We got Brian Graves behind the glass, the always great engineer, Rob Cole, the producer. I'm usually on alone, but tonight I got a co-host with me. Worked with him for a little bit, and now he's in graduate school at Hofstra University. His name is Kyle Gellin. Kyle, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on tonight.
Absolutely. So you want to introduce yourself, like, you know, what fans you are and, you know, what teams you root for?
Absolutely. I'm a Mets fan when it comes to baseball, born and raised thanks to my dad. It's not a choice with that, for
thanks
sure.
Thanks to your dad?
Thanks to my dad. follow the Packers, actually, believe it or not. There's a small little outfit of Packer fans here in New York. And when it comes to basketball, it's kind of a pick of the month. Obviously, I like Golden State right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's usually the Knicks with everyone in New York. But this is what I was thinking the other day. People who are Knicks fans and live in New York, not just live in New York, anyone who's a Knicks fan that's our age has really never seen the Knicks do good at all. No one knows what it's like. We had that one year in, I think it was 12-13, where they had 54 wins, but everyone knew that wasn't going to last. They weren't going to beat the Heat. So just when you talk about basketball and being a Knicks fan our age, I think you're a year older than me,
right.
Like no one knows what it's like to root for a team that's won consecutive couple years.
Yeah, you don't really see them in the playoffs anymore, and I mean, the golden age, hopefully it's coming back. We got Porzingis and everything, but, I mean, until you see it, you're really not going to know.
Not at all, yeah, Porzingis. The Knicks do have a lot to do this offseason. They brought in Jeff Hornacek as the new coach, and which I kind of like too because he's not confined to just the triangle offense, which Derek Fisher was, and that kind of makes me think that Phil Jackson is doing a little bit better of a job because he's sucking up his ego and not saying, you know, it needs to be the triangle. I have to bring a coach in that knows the triangle. He brought in a coach that's a good coach, that's a player's coach. He knows how to win. He was a very respected player. So I like that about him, and I'm curious to see what he's going to do on the court, whether he's going to run the triangle or not, and is it going to work? Because no Knicks coach in the last, what, how many years? 15 years has been successful at all.
Yep, and, you know, Phil's on record at this point saying he doesn't need a coach that's going to run the triangle, but there was a laundry list of coaches out there, and that just seemed to be the sticking point for him in terms of talking to them about it. So he says one thing, and his actions say another.
Yeah, I would have liked Tom Thibodeau, but
absolutely. You
can't always get what you want.
Yep.
So we do have Adam Rubin, who is the ESPNNewYork.com Mets beat reporter. He's coming on the program at 9:10. We'll talk Mets with him later in the program. We will talk NBA Finals, talk Yankees, and, of course, we will have to talk about the passing of two all-time sports legends. In my opinion, probably two of the top 10 athletes of all time in Muhammad Ali and in Gordie Howe, Mr. Hockey. And we were talking before, Gordie Howe was the Wayne Gretzky before Gretzky.
Absolutely. I mean, he held every major record up until that point. I mean, he was playing back when they didn't wear helmets in hockey. So,
yeah.
I mean, he was the gold standard until Gretzky came along. So, I mean, it was definitely a passing of a legend.
Yeah, and not just that, but he played hockey in six different decades. That's like crazy.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Just the level of where it started to where it ended up when he was done and where we're at now.
I'm playing pickup basketball. After one game, I'm dead. I can't imagine playing a full game of hockey when I'm in my 60s.
Right, exactly.
So we'll start off with a little baseball talk, and then we'll transition into Adam Rubin. So we're both diehard Mets fans. The Mets, obviously, we all know, have not been playing well recently. You can look at it from two points of view, and I'm curious which point of view you look at it from. I also want to hear from callers, too. The phone number to call in, I tweeted this as well, is 631-888-8811, 631-888-8811. So is it worth worrying for the Mets because, you know, they haven't been hitting well. They've averaged 3 runs a game over their past 15 games. No offense, you know, injuries, everyone's dropping like flies due to Darnold, David Wright. But on the other side, they are 7 games over. We know what happened last year when they were struggling in May and June. They ended up winning the pennant. So which point of view are you looking at it from?
I really don't think you could pull from last year's. I mean, the odds of that happening again aren't great. I mean, you're not going to get someone like Cespedes to come in and rejuvenate the offense here. They have him on the team already, but he's already been consistent. So you need somebody else to be that X factor to step up. I don't think it's going to be Kelly Johnson. I know he's a good clubhouse guy.
Yeah.
He might be good in a pinch hit situation, but in terms of that, I think they're going to need to go out and get another bat if somebody doesn't start stepping up soon.
Absolutely. And you're not going to get away, even if everybody does come back. I'm not talking about David Wright. I think he's on. But let's say Duda comes back in mid-July and Darnold comes back. Walker, I know now he's a little bit banged up, but let's say he comes back fully healthy. Even with that lineup and everyone healthy, you still need another bat. And I think the problem for the Mets is, too, a little bit right now, that all of their prospects that they kept building up in the farm system are all gone. They don't have a lot of trade beat left.
Yeah, and, I mean, Nimmo doesn't seem to be panning out the way they were planning on him to be. If you look at the list of their draft prospects over the course of the years and who they've drafted, a lot of them have already come through the system and they're already up with the big league club, except for him. I mean, you have Herrera, who's knocking on the door right now, but it just seems like they are going to need another piece if they want to get it done.
It doesn't seem like they want to trade Herrera. Don't even bring him. Nimmo was drafted 5 years ago. Where is this guy? And Jose Fernandez was drafted in the same draft. We all know what he's doing. There's someone else drafted in the 2011 first-round draft behind – oh, I think it was – this is another guy I want to bring up. Michael Fulmer was drafted in round two. You know, you've been following baseball.
Yep.
You know what he did today. You know that he has 28.2 scoreless innings in a row.
I mean, you gave him up to get Cespedes, so it was, you know, one way or the other, you needed to get a guy, and if that's who you had to give up, I mean, the pitching staff isn't the problem right now, so in retrospect, down the road, might we want him when Cespedes is more than likely gone next season? Yes. But, I mean, he got us to the World Series, so he did what we paid him to do.
Of course, and you look at it from the other point of view, had the Mets not made that trade and it was Fulmer up right now, people would be saying, we have too much pitching, we need bats, so let's do the trade. So for any Mets fan out there that is mad that Michael Fulmer is doing great, and let's say Cespedes does leave this year, you can't fault the Mets for that trade whatsoever. On the bright side, you can look at this however way you want, but the Mets have been doing an amazing job scouting pitching. I mean, Harvey, DeGrom, Syndergaard, Mats. I think they have another – they have like Joanna Bacarda. I think this guy's in Double-A. Plus Fulmer. I mean, it's amazing just how stocked the farm system was.
Not to mention Jerry's Familia. He came up as a starting pitcher. They obviously transitioned him to the closer role because of his two elite pitches.
Yeah.
But he started off as a starting pitcher too. So if he had panned out the way that they were expecting, we'd have another stud pitcher in the lineup here.
Yeah, and two more guys that I want to bring up too. Obviously, he was suspended for life. But Henry Mejia was a top prospect. And Rafael Montero, wherever this guy is. So they do have a lot of like young pitchers, and it's a great job that Sandy Alderson's done. We will talk about the Mets right now with Adam Rubin, who joins us on the line. Adam, Eric Getzoff and Kyle Gelling on Sports Talk 1240. How are you?
Excellent, guys. Thanks.
All right, good. All right, so we're going to start off. Obviously, we know the bad news today with Terry Collins. Do we have any update? Do we know if Terry Collins is, you know, doing a little bit better?
Well, John Ricco, the assistant GM, before we left the stadium tonight, said that Terry was going to stay overnight at the hospital in Milwaukee. The team was flying back this evening to New York without him. Trainer Ray Ramirez is going to stay with Terry at the hospital, stay with him overnight, and then hopefully he'll be discharged tomorrow and could return home, but that remains to be seen. John Ricco was unsure whether he would manage the game on Tuesday, said it's too soon to know that. But Terry, by all accounts, felt pretty good by the time he was taken to the hospital about 30 minutes before the game. He had fallen ill earlier that morning, although when we talked to him around 10:30 Central Time, local time, he seemed all right at that point. But people didn't seem overly alarmed, only because by the time Terry went to the hospital, he looked and felt pretty good, they said.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're glad to hear that he's going to be doing well and back with the ball club soon. This is Kyle on speaking with you, and we wanted to get right into, you know, we know your time's short. We want to get right into some baseball stuff here. So the Mets are a team, you know, that lives and dies with the long ball. So do you see them trying to shore up their offense with a more contact hitter here coming up to the All-Star break?
Well, we'll see what they do getting close to the trade deadline. Obviously, last year they were very active getting Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe and Yoenis Cespedes on the offensive side. I'm sure they're going to try to be aggressive again. They've already gotten Loney and Kelly Johnson in recent weeks to try to plug some holes. I'm not sure what's going to happen, though. It's a little early for the trade deadline, although, as I said, we did see those guys get moved hopefully, well, Travis d'Arnaud should be back in about a week. Terry Collins said early this morning before he had the medical issue. Duda and David Wright are going to be a lot longer term absences. So I'm not sure what direction the Mets go, but clearly they have to do something to remedy the offense because they're going to be wasting the pitching otherwise.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We were talking about this before, me and Kyle, right before he came on. Which point of view should fans be looking at with the Mets? Is it the point of view of we can't hit, we've averaged 3 runs a game over the last 15 games, the Nationals are really, really good, or should we look at it from the point of view as, hey, you know what, we are 6 games over, we have d'Arnaud coming back, and we struggled in May and June last year, and we ended up winning the pennant. So, you know, which point of view should Mets fans be looking at? Because, you know, Met fans, everyone's kind of goes crazy. So should we relax or should we kind of be a little bit tense right now?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be tense, but I would be concerned about winning the division. The Nationals are not going to slow down, I don't believe. They're up 4.5 games right now, which is obviously not insurmountable. But this is a team that's really loaded. They're putting up a ton of runs every game. So the Mets may have to settle. I believe the Mets are going to be a playoff team, but it may end up being the wild card game. You could ask the Pirates from last year if you're in a one-game playoff, or the Yankees for that matter. If you're in a one-game playoff, anything could happen. I know the Mets would probably throw like a Noah Syndergaard in that game and feel pretty good about it, but they might be facing a Garrett Cole or someone like that.
Right.
So you never know what's, especially with the Mets hitting, you never know what's going to happen in one game. So I wouldn't feel overly comfortable, but certainly getting d'Arnaud back we'll see if that helps. I mean, he wasn't tearing it up before he landed on the DL in the first place anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the Nationals just seem like last year was a fluke for them. This is the team that everyone was expecting them to be last season, and they're going to have to keep pace with them if they want a shot at that pennant title. You're mentioning d'Arnaud here, so obviously when he's coming back, more than likely Plawecki will be sent down to the minors. What problems and issues are you seeing with his swing right now? I mean, he's just not making contact at the levels that he did in college and in the minors.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and when you get in a rut, it kind of exacerbates itself and you're trying too hard and maybe you're going outside of strike zone and stuff like that. He had the dismal game that everyone's going to point to is Friday when he twice batted with the bases loaded and nobody out in the ninth and the 11th inning and both times popped out. That's, I mean, kind of inexcusable right there. So I'm sure he's the one when d'Arnaud comes back is going to end up in AAA. Rene Rivera, yeah, the average isn't that great, but the defense is pretty sound. So he's going to be the guy who's probably going to remain the backup with Plawecki trying to get himself right in AAA.
Do you think the Mets will wait for both Duda and d'Arnaud to come back to see what they do in terms of making an acquisition before making a trade for a hitter? Or do you think the Mets would make a move like before they come back?
Well, I don't think you're going to see Duda anytime soon. I don't know if you're going to see him before that trade deadline.
Wow.
He's in that period now where David Wright missed 2 full months with a stress fracture in his lower back when he had it in 2011. Duda went on the DL May 23rd. So, I mean, if he misses 2 months, he's coming back right at the a week before the trade deadline. So, and if there's any kind of setback or it takes a little bit longer, he's even coming back after the trade deadline. So, mm-hmm. I'm not sure they'll know completely about Lucas Duda before that trade deadline arrives. Obviously, third base is a place they could upgrade because David, I'm sure he'll try to come back for September, but I mean, David has to be idle for, 6 to 8 weeks, and that's idle or not doing any baseball stuff for 6 to 8 weeks, I think it was, and then maybe if everything's breaking right, he could start ramping up a little bit, but he's going to be gone for a considerable period too.
Yeah, how long do you expect this to go before Sandy starts addressing this issue more seriously? I mean, can you see them possibly asking Walker to switch to third in free agency? I mean, he's been one of our most consistent hitters here. You'd hate to lose him, especially with how well you're seeing Murphy doing for the Nationals. I mean, he just seems like a solid second base choice. But if he could play third base and, you know, Wright's not looking like he's coming back anytime soon, can you see that being an option?
Well, Terry said they've at least internally discussed bringing up Dilson Herrera to play second and sliding Walker over to third, but
right.
They've resisted because changing positions, even changing infield positions, is not easy. And I know Neil Walker has played some third base, particularly in the minors, but I don't think it's something they're considering right now. I think the acquisition of Kelly Johnson is the interim try, and if things get dire, maybe they'll do that, but I don't think they're there just yet.
Adam, who and when can we expect the first long-term contract to be? Obviously, Conforto, DeGrom, Syndergaard, Mats. Do you know, like, when and who would be the first guy to kind of, you know, for Sandy and Co. to lock up?
I'm not sure there's any urgency to do any of the guys. I don't know if we'll see any of them at this point this season. So I mean, maybe it's something that comes up during spring training next year with somebody. I mean, Harvey is the first one at free agency, but I doubt it's going to happen with him. He's not eligible for free agency until after the 2018 season. The guy, other guys are all 2019 and beyond. So with Syndergaard, I don't, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think. Syndergaard's probably the, DeGrom's probably the first of 2019, and the other guys are 2020 or so. So I don't know if there's any urgency, especially with pitchers. I don't know if you want to give pitchers, even young pitchers, a 6-year deal, especially when you control them for 3 or 4 seasons as it is anyway. So we'll see how it plays out, but I'm certainly not Darnold at this point because of his injury history. Conforto's a Boris guy like Matt Harvey. He just debuted last year, so he's got 5 full years after this until free agency. So I don't see anyone anytime soon unless it's next year spring training, maybe like a DeGrom or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd love to see them lock up at least a few of those guys, right?
Well, I mean, they're going to be together for as the, Harvey's the first free agency, after,
right?
And that's after the 2018 season. So all the other guys are going to be together through at least 2019. So you're talking 3 more full seasons after the season. We're only a couple of months into the season, so I really wouldn't fret about this getting broken up just yet.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to switch gears here a little bit and get your thoughts on the Mets pulling from their local talent pool here. Drafted their first 2 picks as local talent pitchers out of Boston College and UConn, but they're Long Island guys from their high school days. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a nice story, and they said it wasn't really their intention to just take local guys with the first couple picks, but it worked out that way. Justin Dunn, the first overall pick, or their first overall pick, out of Freeport, although he went to high school in Connecticut, it looks like, he went to Boston College. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I imagine he's going to sign. And then the really nice story, even though he's the second pick overall, was Anthony Kay out of Ward Melville High School out in Stony Brook area. He pitched at the same high school as Steven Matz. So it's funny, Steven Matz obviously had a ton of success at Stony Brook, gets drafted by the Mets. The next season, Anthony Kay throws the first pitch of the year for Ward Melville. So they never overlap, but it was kind of seamless. And for one Long Island high school to have 2 first-round picks come out of it since 2009 is pretty incredible.
Adam Rubin is on the line now. Eric Getzoff and Kyle Gelling on Sports Talk 1240. Adam is the New York Mets beat reporter for ESPN NewYork.com. Does a fantastic job. Adam, obviously, we all know the struggles for the Mets at third base. David Wright, I don't think he's played over 120 games 5 of the last 6 seasons. How long do you think it'll take for Sandy to address the third base issue? Because there's a bunch of guys that are playing on teams that aren't doing so well. 2, for example, Danny Valencia on the Athletics, Brian Dozier. I know he plays second base for the Twins. Maybe they can convert him to a third baseman. And then, of course, the big name that everyone loves, Todd Frazier from the White Sox, even though they are playing well. But how long do you think it'll take for Sandy and his team to kind of address that issue at third?
Well, I mean, last year the way they addressed it was to get Jose Uribe, who could be a starter, could be – I'm sorry, Juan Uribe, getting a little old I think that's the kind of move they would make, if anything, because I don't think they want to bring in somebody that's going to preclude David Wright being the third baseman next year or anything like that. The big question for me is, how is it going to end with David Wright? Because clearly he's not going to be able to stay on the field until the end of his contract in 2020. So I'm sure he tries to come back late this year. I imagine he's in spring training next year. But you look at how Don Mattingly, when he had the lower back issue, he had to retire at age 34. David turns 34 this December. So clearly, and that's not even talking about the herniated disc in his neck, which is why he's on the DL now, but clearly the back issue alone is something that's probably going to consume David Wright at some point sooner than later. So it's sad to see, but David clearly is probably in his last year or two of playing for the Mets, you would think.
Yeah, you hate to see that. He's such a high character guy for the team. Like, they give him that money because he's a great player, but also because he represents the team so well. So I don't really see him staying past his years and, you know, trying to just take them for some paychecks here. I think he will step away when the time is right. But, you know, he's got to give it at least a couple of more shots here before he ultimately pulls the plug on it.
Well, the silver lining for the Mets, too, and it's not going to be like a Michael Goddard situation where he leaves money on the table. Because David, if he's physically unable to perform, the Mets have insurance on the contract. Once David misses 60 days, starting with day 61, the Mets get back 75% of his salary and insurance. So he makes $20 million a year for the next few years. Let's say he, just academically, let's say he doesn't play at all next year or doesn't come back again. next year he may be owed $20 million, but insurance is going to pick up $15 million of that. So clearly the Mets have a soft landing with this contract if it ends up that David just can't physically perform.
Here's the big thing that every Mets fan wants to know is that will the Mets reinvest that money? You know what I mean?
Well, last year they got some of the insurance money back because David missed 160 games or 60 days and ended up getting UNSS for this. So everything's complicated with the Mets. I don't know how much higher the payroll is going to go after they got Cespedes and they committed to him for 3 years. They do obviously have this Madoff thing swirling around. They had to make a $16 million payment at the start of the month. And it's not the Mets per se, but it's the Mets owners and their charities and businesses, which includes the Mets. So that money has to come from somewhere. They owe another, I forgot off the top of my head, but $30 million or so over the next few years as part of that settlement. So that money has to come from somewhere. So I don't know how much higher you're going to see the payroll, especially if the attendance levels off a little bit now because people are a little less enthusiastic about the team. If they really start winning again and the attendance keeps going up, potentially you can see an increase in payroll. But I'm not sure absent that you're going to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's just – they're going to have to wait to see how it pans out. We're on with Adam Rubin here. Adam live tweets the Mets games, and for anyone who does follow him, he frequently tweets out "Oh no!" a lot more recently than I'd like to see. But I wanted to get your where did that come from? Was it spontaneous, or did it come from somewhere? Because it's you know gotten quite a following since the first one.
Yeah, no, it was pretty much spontaneous. I might have even blurted it out loud and then tweeted it, and it's kind of caught fire. I've used a bunch of shticks over the years, and that's kind of the one that's had some staying power of all of them. So I actually have kind of pulled back a little bit over the last several days because Met fans are, when things are going well, it's kind of funny. When things aren't going well, I think people just get a little more annoyed by it. So kind of pulled back a little bit recently because the Mets are obviously, even though they went 5-5 on this trip, they're still kind of struggling. It didn't feel like a 5-5 trip because of all the things that went on this trip.
A big question that I have, and this is looking much more long-term, probably not like till 6-7 years down the road, but Carlos Beltran is having a rejuvenated season with the Yankees right now. I was looking at his career numbers, and it kind of struck me that he's almost like a borderline Hall of Famer, and then I realized who would he go in with, and it would have to be as a Met. Do you think that, listen, I this would only be if Carlos Beltran is inducted into the Hall of Fame, and if he goes in as a Met, but do you think Cooperstown would say, Carlos, you know, you're going in as a Met? Because, you know what I mean? Like, his time with the Mets didn't really connect with him as much as they connected with Seaver and Piazza.
Well, Wally Matthews and I actually have a show on Sunday mornings on ESPN Radio in New York, and we actually talked about that a little bit today ourselves. And Wally asked Beltran in the last few days, who would you go in as? And I don't know if he answered it directly, but he basically said his best years were with the Mets. I still contend that, because even though he spent the same number of years with the Mets as with the Royals at the major league level, and he came up through the Royals system after being drafted by them, so he spent more years with the Royals. I'm sure, even though he's so far removed from it, because he can end up playing 20 years in the majors, and only his first seven were with the Royals. But I would think the likelihood is that he would end up wearing a Royals hat. But part of that is because there's so much acrimony with the Mets over the years. Maybe that's lessened a little bit as time has passed on, but if you remember one year he ended up having knee surgery in Colorado and the mm-hmm. Mets went public saying he didn't have permission to do so. There were so many little or big dust-ups like that and conflicts that I'm sure there's some a sore subject. Now the players don't completely get to choose anymore because some people abuse it. Like for instance Dave Winfield is in the Hall of Fame as a Padre, and I think Wade Boggs is in as a Devil Ray. So the Hall of Fame kind of jerks back the who gets to choose, but they do take a lot of input from the player, so I'm sure they'll solicit Beltran's input, and it'll be interesting to see which way it goes. But he told Wally he wants to play another couple of years, and then you're not even on the ballot for 5 years after that. So this is a debate that was 2016, so in about 2023 we're going to be having this debate.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how the fan base would react to something like that. There's no love lost there. I mean, as soon as he ended up leaving the Mets, he kind of ripped the fan base saying that, yeah. You know, the Yankees fans are more supportive, and even though they get on you for the negatives, they're more into the game and they're more knowledgeable. I just think that rubbed a lot of loyal Met fans the wrong way after they were rooting for him for so long.
Yeah, but, you know, I think a lot of Met fans, as time has passed, don't hold as deep a grudge over that curveball from Adam Wainwright, and they recognize he had a body of work over 6.5 years that was very, very solid for the Mets. He played through injuries, including, I remember, when he and Mike Cameron collided in the outfield in San Diego. Beltran could have had surgery to correct something, I think it was a broken bone in his face, and he ended up playing, coming back less than a week later and playing through that injury. So, and clearly he's a tougher guy than people gave him credit for, and I think people recognize the body work. Plus, the trade to the Giants ended up landing Zach Wheeler, so it did work out for the Mets from that perspective, too.
Absolutely. Well, Adam, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much. Adam is the New York Mets beat reporter for ESPNNewYork.com. And you, I'm sorry, you just you're hosting a show with Wallace Matthews now on ESPN, right? Okay. Yeah, he's hosting with Wallace Matthews now. I think from 7 to 9 a.m. on Sunday mornings, does a very good job. If you're a diehard Mets fan, you follow the Mets on Twitter. Everyone knows Adam, so did a great job. And listen, that Carlos Beltran question is a big question. I didn't think that he played as many years with the Royals, but now I look it up, and I got to tell you, Kyle, I'm happy that he played that many years with the Royals, because now he's going to go in with them. There's no love lost there.
Yep, absolutely.
And listen, he did have a bad breakup with the Mets. Like, a couple things, yeah. He had that surgery in 2010. First off, he missed like 2 full years. In 2009 and 2010, he was terrible. In 2005, he played 151 games, but he was bad. So I think he had 6.5 years with the Mets. And he was good for 3.5 of those good years. You can look at it from this point of view, saying that Carlos Beltran is probably like the third best outfielder in Mets history. Tommy Agee, Lenny Dykstra, Darryl Strawberry is obviously there, but Carlos Beltran's got to be in the mix. So, listen, I'm just happy that he played that many years with the Royals. Adam did a great job, but we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back on Sports Talk 1240, we will be talking NBA Finals, talking some Yankees, and we will be talking about the passing, the unfortunate passing of Gordie Howe and Muhammad Ali. We'll be right back on Sports Talk 1240.
Listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
This is Kyle Gelling, Sports Talk Radio on WGBB Network. We were just on here with ESPN's Adam Rubin talking about the Mets. Had some very good points regarding where the team's at right now offensively, what they need to do in the future, and just how long they can hold out for the reprieve of getting Travis d'Arnaud back in the lineup. Now, as a lot of you remember, d'Arnaud wasn't really smashing the ball when he was here with us for that short period of time. He tends to be injury-prone here, but they definitely need to fill that gap. Plueki looks like a fish out of water at the plate, and it just seems like in the long term, is he really going to pan out for us? We don't know, but we do know that we need some shot in the arm here in terms of our offense. The past few series have been a little dismal. I know that we got a couple of wins here with the Rockies, but let's face it, it's the Rockies. They got to compete against teams like the Pittsburgh Pirates if they really want a shot at the pennant. They need to put together some wins here if they're going up against the Nationals, because they just seem like such a tough opponent. You know, you could hope that they're going to sweep them down the stretch here like they did last year, but let's be realistic. I mean, they need to pile in the wins when they can against the weaker opponents here. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's just like what it's all about, baseball.
Yep.
You got to beat up the bad teams, and you go 500. This is what really baseball is. It's like you're going to win 60 games, at least 60. You're going to lose at least 60. It's what you do in between those 40. That's what it really is all about. You know, we'll stay on the topic for the Mets here. I'm sorry. We'll stay on the topic of baseball. Transition from the Mets to the team that they beat in the NLCS last year. How about the Cubs this year? You know what they're on pace for right now? I think they're on pace for 115 wins. It's out of control. And you know what the lowest ERA of their pitching staff is this year? I think it's 2.92.
I know they have two through, I think, six in the NL
in ERA.
are in their rotation right now, yes.
So the everyone in their rotation is in the top six in ERA. Who's the other guy? Probably Kershaw?
Yeah, probably. You can't compete with that, so.
It's unbelievable. Arrieta, Lester, Hamill. Who are the two other guys? They got Brunton Lackey and then... there's someone else, but it's amazing because they're just dominating in every facet of the game. And not to mention Jason Hayward hasn't done anything this year. It's a matter of time when he gets started. How, you know, this team, they're 43-18 right now. And I was reading an article that according to the Sabermetrics and the plus minus, I don't know, some stupid math that all these new guys do, they should be like 46-15. It's insane.
I mean, and you have the Schwarber injury, and you would think that they'd need some time to adjust to that. And no, this is a young team.
Yeah.
They're so confident already in their abilities. They're just rolling with the punches and, you know, punching everyone else in the mouth.
And apparently they have a top prospect in their farm system who is ready to be called up pretty soon. Yeah, I forgot what position he is, but I saw that John Heyman tweeted something. They were thinking about calling him up soon. But that just goes to show you. And this kind of brings up another point about the Yankees too. It's that the Yankees are now going from being a team where they didn't build from the farm system at all in the mid 2000s. That was who we know. Bernie, Jeter, Pettit, that whole thing. But now they're building from the farm system, and the Cubs are obviously doing a great job of it because a lot of these superstars are not becoming free agents at all. These teams are locking them up before they can hit free agency. You saw it in Mike Trout. You've seen it in Steven Strasburg. All of these guys are getting big contracts. So this brings us now right into the Yankees, how you know, Cashman has been doing a good job at building them long term and not trading away their future, because in a way that's like their only future.
Yep. And you know, we were talking about David Wright earlier. He's kind of like, in my mind, he was the last guy who was going to come up with a team and stay with them through the longevity of their career. You know, another guy that comes to mind is Chipper Jones. And all these other guys are switching teams. You know, David Price, for instance, takes off one hat, puts on another almost every single year. You're seeing these young guys, you know, Zach Wheeler pleading with Sandy not to be traded. Yeah. Trout's locked in. Stanton's locked in. We have a lot of guys here in this upcoming generation who are young right now who could be finishing their careers with the team that they started
Stanton with. Stanton, too. Forgot about him. All these Yankee fans. Listen, if you're a Yankee fan out there, I get it. You're waiting for Harvey to be a free agent, for Harper to be a free agent, because that's what you're used to. But I got to tell you something. Don't bank on it. Your chances, honestly, I would probably put them at 25% because of a couple of things. One, the Yankees aren't the only team that has money anymore. The Dodgers have money. The Red Sox have money. The Nationals have money. You saw what they just gave out. Number two, a lot of these guys like to stay in the same place. I get that Harper grew up as a diehard Yankee fan and he wants to play for the Yankees. But a lot of these guys just feel comfortable because of the place where they're winning. And that brings us to my next point, number three. The Nationals are going to be good the next 3 years. The Yankees aren't. So why would Bryce Harper want to go to a team that hasn't been winning the past couple of years from a team such as the Nationals where projections look like they're going to be good the next 3 years? So if you're a Yankee fan out there, and tell me if you agree with me, Kyle, but like, you can't bank on these guys.
I mean, these Yankee fans are thinking as if it's the league 20, 30 years ago, where they're the New York Yankees and their payroll is that much bigger than everyone else. Bud Selig did a great job at restructuring this league to make sure that teams like the Royals are contenders year in and year out.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't the case back then. They can't pay their way out of it like they used to because all these other teams are using sabermetrics and they're using the caps that they've placed on them to be competitive. So they need something else.
Yeah, and you got to live. You just gave a lot of credit to Seelig, which I totally agree with. You also have to give a lot of credit to the small market teams, such as the Royals, such as the. You could say the Cubs. They're not really a small market team, but they did it that way. The Baltimore Orioles, they built through the farm system. Even the Red Sox aren't a small market team, but they've built through the system. And you got to give these teams credit because they had to change up their ways a little bit. They had to change it up. It's like the Darwinism theory, like only the strongest will survive. In a way, these teams weren't going to survive if they didn't learn sabermetrics and didn't build from the farm system. And because that's working, now you're seeing a transition to the big market teams doing it that way. The Yankees doing it that way. The Mets, obviously, they're not a big market team anymore because of the stupid Wilpons. But the Mets are doing it that way now, too, because they saw that buying all these free agents, you don't win. So they're the small market teams are kind of changing the game.
Yeah, you know what? The big market teams weren't worried about it, and then you have a team like the Athletics come along with Moneyball, and now they're playing catch-up because all these other teams were forced to do it earlier, and they weren't. They just threw their checkbooks at everybody, and it's not working for them, so now they have to adjust. I'm just looking at draft coverage the other day, and they were showing the Mets draft picks, first-round picks, over the past seven seasons, five of which, I believe, are already up in the big leagues. Then they compared that with the Yankees, and none of them are up in the big leagues.
No one.
Nobody.
And you know what's weird about the Yankees, too? I mean, you heard about Jesus Montero got traded years ago, but with the Yankees, you always hear about these young studs who are, like, ready to come up, but none of them, like, ever come up. It's kind of weird. Like, you heard Jesus Montero. You've been hearing about Aaron Judge for a while. I remember... I mean, they had a bunch of Andrew Brackman. He was like a first-round pick a while ago. Ian Kennedy. You heard about all these guys. Maybe it's just because the Yankees, they get a lot of publicity. But none of those guys, like, ever come up. It's weird. With other teams, they come up and they play good. With the Yankees, I don't know. Who's, like, the last guy to, like, come up and, like, be a stud?
Jeter.
Yeah. Jeter, Pettit, Bernie, Rivera, that group. And so I want to ask you this question. I definitely want to hear from some of you listeners. The number is 631-888-8811, 631-888-8811. Has Brian Cashman done a good job as the Yankees GM in building for the long term, or has he been bad in not making it far into the playoffs the last 3 years, considering the size of the Yankees payroll?
I'm going to answer that in two parts. I think that as a GM, just looking at it face value, he has done a good job with this team. I think that he built a winning product. You can't take anything away from the 90s Yankees. I mean, they were a dynasty.
Yeah.
He did what he needed to do, but that was when they were pulling from their minor league talent. He kind of luck of the draw here. He got a ton of good players to come up, and it just seemed to work out.
Because he took over in 98. It wasn't his team at all.
Exactly. And that same point, you had George Steinbrenner breathing down your neck every day, so he was forced to make these moves. Otherwise, he was losing his job. I mean, you have to remember, Steinbrenner fires managers, like, it was every other week he was firing a manager.
Yeah.
And he was always on the hot seat. Even in the 2000 World Series, Cashman's on record saying that Steinbrenner went into his office and said that the series was basically for New York and that, sternly told him they better win that series.
Even though they won three of the past 4 years?
Correct. That was the series where his job was basically, it seemed like, according to him, he didn't say it expressly, but you could tell in the tone of it that, I mean, he would have been on the chopping block if it didn't pan out the way that it did. So now you got Hal and the new regime in here, and they seem a little less hands-off. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's gotten comfortable, but you have these huge contracts that he signed when George was the GM and he needed to win, and now they're kind of handcuffed with it until...
They also do have a lot of contracts that they gave to him when George left, and I agree with you, too. I think he's done a good job. The bad thing is giving out these contracts to Jacoby Ellsbury, to Brian McCann. I mean, maybe the McCann one was good, but the Ellsbury contract was dumb. I still, even though Beltran's having a good year, to give a guy like that a 3-year, $45 million deal where he really can't play the outfield that much was kind of dumb.
Especially when you know you have A-Rod as your DH. I mean, he's not playing the field, so.
Yeah, it didn't make sense. You look at it from the other way, though. Brian Cashman had so much pressure on him when George was the boss and when George was alive and running the team that it kind of wasn't even Cashman's role as GM. Steinbrenner was kind of the GM. Now that Steinbrenner is gone, and George is obviously unfortunately no longer alive and he's not kind of running the show with the Yankees, I feel like it's kind of like freed up Cashman to create the minor league system that he always wanted. And you know what? He's made some actually pretty shrewd moves recently. The Aroldis Chapman move, they didn't give up anything. And even though the Yankees may not make it far this year, or may not even make the playoffs or be in contention, it's a great trade chip to get because you can trade him off in the trade deadline and get prospects. Not to mention the Starlin Castro trade, they didn't give up anything for him either. So he's good at making those small deals. The problem is sometimes he gets crazy, and it could not even be him. It could be the Steinbrenner saying, go out and get me Jacoby Ellsbury, get me Brian McCann, get me Masahiro Tanaka, another maybe not-so-great signing. So that's – you know, you can look at it, Brian Cashman's tenure in so many different ways.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. So the Yankees' biggest selling point this season was their amazing bullpen. They were going to shut down the game in the seventh inning, and it was going to be lights out the rest of the way through.
Yeah.
They go out, they sign Chapman to over $11 million this season. He has the domestic violence, the gun charge in the offseason. He has to sit out 29 games. It was supposed to be 30. There was a rainout, so out of a technicality, it was 29. But he's appeared in 15 games. He has 11 saves, so he's doing a great job in that role.
Yeah.
But with the Yankees 5.5 games out, they're kind of on the fringe here of, you know, 1 foot in, 1 foot out. Are they going to be a contender? What do you do with Chapman with the trade deadline coming up? Because the odds of re-signing him next year, they're going to have to spend a ton. I mean, yeah. Is that really worth it with a team that's not going to be putting up a ton of
Chapman's runs? A free agent after this year, right?
Yeah, it's 1 year, just a little over $11 million.
Well, I want to ask you this question, and answer it first and then get back to me. How far out do the Yankees need to be to trade Chapman? Because if the Yankees are 2 games out, you know they're the Yankees and they won't do it. But let me ask you a question. If they're 6 or 5.5 out, like, how far out do you think they need to be to trade Chapman?
I would say 8 games would be a comfortable number.
Yeah.
It just depends on how well these other teams are playing. I mean, you're looking at the Boston Red Sox. Their offense is comparable to the Cubs right now. I mean, they're putting up some big numbers with some young guys.
Poppy's hitting 350.
Do you think he'll be retiring after the season? I know he said he was, but it'd be great if you go out on top like that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's not like he's John Elway where, you know, he's winning. And if he wins the World Series, I could totally see him going out like that. But if it's on, you know, they make it to the ALCS and lose, like, do you think he considers it?
I think he still will. But if I was him, I would say that I'm going to play again next year and say next year is my last year. And then keep doing that because I think that's helping him a little bit.
Yeah, it might be. Easing him at the plate.
Yeah. But getting back to the Chapman thing, I do think that if the Yankees – I think if the Yankees are 6, 5 out, it may be too close come the trade deadline. But if they're 6 out or more, you trade Chapman. And this is also what you do. You trade Carlos Beltran and you trade Mark Teixeira. You trade everyone you can because once you realize that the Yankees, you're not going far and you're not going to make the playoffs. And it's also hard because, like, it's hard to say, yeah, we're good enough to make the playoffs, but we're not good enough to go far. Because in baseball, anything can happen. You know that. So the question is, are we good enough to make a run to make the playoffs? And then anything can happen. So I think that if the Yankees are 6 or more out, you get rid of everyone. You get rid of Chapman. You get rid of Beltran. You get rid of Teixeira. And you restock for the future. Because the way that the Yankees are built right now, maybe not for 17, but it's starting in 18. And I think they're going to start being good.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think of that?
I do, but at the same time, you have Teixeira, who's an injury risk.
Yeah.
You're not going to get rid of him if you're not going to get, like, at least some substantial midway players or minor league prospects, and I just don't know if teams are going to be willing to give that up, not knowing what they're getting out of it. If it's a team that's in the playoff runs and, you know, they think that his bat will help, yes, but it's not like he's performing at the level that he was last season where you could really justify making that move.
Then again, if I'm the Yankees and I know I'm not going to make it far, I would give up Teixeira for a single-A guy. Like, why not?
Yeah, you have Bird coming up. I mean, he's going to fill that role.
Bird's the first baseman of the future. The Castro trade was great at second. Gregorius at short. You got to look for an answer at third base long term, I would say. And then in the outfield, Gardner's there. Ellsbury, who hasn't been playing good. So I think the Yankees long term, you need to look for one more a third baseman and an outfielder.
Yeah.
That's really it. So I know let's get into some NBA talk, too. NBA Finals. We had the whole LeBron James, Draymond Green scandal. Draymond Green was suspended I didn't even see it, but you told me. I think it was like a ball tap on LeBron. So that's what he did. And he got suspended, so he's out for game 5. So here's what I think, and tell me if you're correct. I don't think Draymond was suspended for what he did, but it's the small things that added up to this, you know? Like, this was the, like, you know how, like, World War One started, like, Franz Ferdinand, that was, you know what I mean? Like there was a bunch of stuff, and that was, like, the icing on the cake to start it. This was, like, the icing on the cake where he did a lot of stuff beforehand, and then the small little flick kind of sent them off and stood in for game five.
Yeah, when you develop a reputation like that in the league, they're going to just look for an excuse to get you out of there. I mean, if it came down to LeBron and him going to blows, I mean, you know what? I give Draymond a lot of respect in that he's a gamer. He gets up for every game and he gets the team energized. When that whole thing went down and LeBron started coming at him, he knew that with the amount of technicals and flagrants that he's had, that he was on risk anyway. So he backed away. He knew that he was doing the right thing. And you know what? I feel bad for him because they're going back to Golden State to probably finish off the series on Monday, and he's going to have to do it on the bench. Like, you don't want to see that.
Yeah. Well, is he going to be able to be there to, like, celebrate afterwards?
I think he will be on the bench. I just don't think he's able to play.
All right, so I'm sure he's fine with that. And here's a question I want to bring up, too. Like, would the NBA ever suspend LeBron? Because what I felt LeBron, what he did was so much worse, because LeBron there were three things I saw. LeBron, like, elbowed Draymond, pushed him, and not to mention, like, stepped over him in a way that was just, like, condescending, which you're not going to get suspended for. You can just step wherever you want. But I thought what LeBron did was a lot worse. But would the NBA ever suspend LeBron James?
Unless he came to blows with someone, I cannot see them suspending him for anything. I mean, he's the face of the league. He has been, basically, since he came up. They know where the money is and they know where the viewership is. You're not suspending a guy like that. I mean, just the way that they call fouls when he's playing defense like that. I mean, he was literally throwing Steph Curry in the game the other night, and Steph went to go complain, and LeBron got right in his face right in front of the referee. I mean, he can basically do whatever he wants as long as it's not going over the line.
And I think ABC would have a little bit to say about that too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and listen, I don't think they ever would suspend it, because if they suspended LeBron James, the game would be over. There'd be no chance of any close game, any chance of a Cleveland Cavaliers comeback. And I don't like the suspension at all, but the thing is, it doesn't kill the series. It doesn't kill the Warriors. And the amazing thing about the Warriors is that their bench is so loaded. Draymond Green comes out, you just stick in Andre Iguodala. You stick in Sean Livingston. You can even stick in Harrison Barnes. Any of these guys. It's just like they're so deep.
It is unbelievable just how stacked they are, and it's with people who know how to win. You have Andre Iguodala. He was the face of the 76ers, and he stepped in at a time when Allen Iverson stepped away. So those were some big shoes to fill. And, I mean, just look at the body of work he had in the finals last year. He was their X factor. I mean, he's a guy who has the same build and stature as someone like LeBron James, and he can guard him perfectly. I mean, I don't really think anyone else in the league really matches up with him athleticism and body-wise. Like, there's nobody. But if someone's going to be the guy who's going to do that, it's Iggy.
Yeah, it's Iggy. And the amazing thing about the Warriors, too, is that, like, when Curry and Thompson don't have good games, anyone can step up.
Those first two games were unbelievable. If you're telling me that they're going to score 12 points combined in those games and they're going to win, I think it might have been 12 the first one, 14 the second, something like that. Wow. They weren't playing well.
Yeah.
Then you have someone who I think Sean Livingston is going to be the MVP when it's all said and done here. People don't really remember this. When he was coming up, he was the next Penny Hardaway. And unfortunately, just like Penny, he got injured and it kind of sidetracked his career here. But you see what he does when he's shooting in the field goal. I mean, it's unbelievable. No one matches up with him.
Yeah, no one. And the guy, what is he? He's 6'7", 192 pounds, but he's a point guard. So he's almost too fast to be guarded by the small guys, but too tall to be guarded by the big guys. Do you remember Sean Livingston's injury with the Clippers?
Yes, it was brutal.
Yeah, it was disgusting.
I mean, don't go to YouTube and watch it, because if you get grossed out with those types of injuries, I mean, his leg literally snapped.
Yeah, unbelievable. You remember the Baron Davis injury with the Knicks? If you remember that, this injury with Sean Livingston was like 10 times worse. And it's almost like a great story, too, because he's just resurrected. He had a really good year with the Nets 2 years ago, I remember, too. And then he's been with the Warriors since 2014. If this guy is the MVP, it would be a good story in two ways. One, the comeback that he made. And two, the fact that If the Warriors went back-to-back, Curry or Thompson wouldn't be the MVP. It would be two bench guys in Iguodala and Sean Livingston. So let me ask you this question, too. Do you think that makes the Warriors – you think that kills Curry and Thompson's legacy a little bit because they didn't win the MVP? Or does it help them showing how good of teammates they are, you know, getting everybody involved and two other guys winning the MVP?
Sure. Well, just for the one point here, Iguodala actually was starting in the finals.
Oh, he was?
Yes, okay. He was a starter during the finals. He was a bench player leading up until that okay. point. They just liked the mismatch there. Now, as far as Curry and Klay Thompson's legacy goes, I think that it just solidifies just how solid this team is. You had Curry missed a ton of time here in the playoffs, and they didn't miss a beat. I mean, the Thunder gave him a scare there, and I think that they needed that going into the finals just to give him a reality check. They played so tough the next two games against the Cavaliers, and that's why they didn't need Curry and Clay because everyone was on alert.
Yeah.
But I think that you look at a guy like Kobe, I mean, he has five championships. The first three, he was not MVP.
No.
So if down the line Curry's winning championships and he is the guy, I don't think anyone – even remembers it. And not to mention, he's the first unanimous MVP, and he's back-to-back MVP. I mean, yeah. It's a nice trophy to have, but he'd rather have the ring.
He was really the first unanimous MVP ever?
Yes.
Guy.
LeBron missed it by a vote. Yeah. I think that maybe it was... Who was it?
Someone else was really close?
Yeah, maybe it was Dr. J. It was an old-time player who almost made it, but this is the first unanimous MVP that we've ever seen.
And you know what's crazy about Curry, too? And I wish we had more time because I love talking about the Warriors, love watching them play. Curry's, like, changing the way that a lot of young kids are playing basketball because they want to be just like Curry, shooting up all these shots instead of driving into the rim. That's not to say Curry's not a great driver, doesn't know how to do that, but his primary move is a shooter, and it's almost like he's the guy that everyone looks up to now. Because no one can look up to LeBron. No one has that body. You can't, you know what I mean? Like, LeBron's not relatable. It's not his fault, but it's just the truth. Kobe was. Jordan, everyone loved Jordan. But like Curry, this guy's a 6'2", lanky guy, and he just puts up these shots. So he's not just like changing the NBA, but like he's changing the way that young kids are learning how to play and like how they're creating their own games. It's amazing.
Well, you know, the last game, the Warriors broke the record for the NBA Finals. They had more three-pointers than two-pointers. They had 17 in the game. Like, to think that a team can not score more field goals and still win the game.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime they're down, they can come back because they just run. Not to mention, they're not running down the shot clock when they're down. They're coming down and just throwing it up, and it goes in more times than it doesn't. It's unbelievable.
And this is my opinion, too. May sound crazy, and I may be wrong by like a team or two, but it's not like a crazy afterthought. I think the Warriors could be the best team in any sport of all time. And you got a lot of teams up there. You have the 17-0 Miami Dolphins. You have the Murderers Row New York Yankees. You have, I'm not like a diehard hockey fan, but I'm sure there's like an amazing hockey team, you know, one of the older teams or whatever, one of the Canadian teams back when. You can even bring up obviously the 96 Bulls. But what the Warriors have done, 73 wins, having such a loaded team, not to mention their amazing, amazing series against the Thunder coming back from 3-1. Kyle, like, dude, I don't know. You think that's like a crazy thought that they're the best team ever?
I don't think it's a crazy thought, but they might not even be the best team in their sport. I mean, people still go to the Bulls as saying that they are the greatest team of all time. But I got news for you. If Michael Jordan's out for as long as Curry was out in the playoffs, they're probably not going as far as they went. I mean, and they get the knock that the league isn't, you know, as physical as it was back then. The physicality in the playoffs and in the finals this season is far and away anything I've seen in the past few seasons. Yeah. And they're banging with these guys, and they're doing a good job of beating them. So, I mean, on paper, you can't argue it. They have the most wins of all time of any team. Yeah. So, on paper, yes, but there's always going to be critics out there.
Of course. There's always going to be – and I understand it, too. I'm only 23. What are you, 24, 25?
25.
Okay, so listen, we're 23 and 25-year-old kids. We were born in 1992 and 1990. Like, granted, I know the history and I know what the records and the stories of the 1908 Cubs and the 1927 Yankees. The 1939 Yankees are one of those teams always mentioned. I get it. And I understand it. And you can definitely make an argument. In my lifetime, and you can definitely make an argument about it, too, that the Warriors are the best team of all time. We have a quick 5 minutes. I wish we had more, but we definitely wanted to get to this. Muhammad Ali and Gordie Howe, two legends that passed away of all time. I know we were talking about this earlier. Gordie Howe just kind of like he was Gretzky before Gretzky.
Yeah, I mean he changed the game in a lot of ways, and you hate to see something like that. I mean, the same day as Muhammad Ali's memorial service is the day that he passes, and it's almost, I don't want to say a shame because that's not the right word for it, but I mean he's going to get his due and his respect and everything like that, but you just don't like to see it being overshadowed by something like Ali. I mean, yeah. His memorial service, he had over 100,000 people in Kentucky come out just to watch the procession drive through the streets, and then they sold out the Yum Center for his for the service. And I'm not sure if you saw it, but they had Billy Crystal, Bill Clinton gave eulogies. They had Will Smith, Lennox Lewis, and Mike Tyson as pallbearers. I mean, it was a star-studded event, and it was a celebration of his life as opposed to a sad occasion. And I mean, some of the speeches they gave. Billy Crystal gave a little tidbit from his 15 rounds stand-up and gave a spot-on Ali impression just like he did when he was coming up on the comedy circuit. It was great.
I got to watch that. I heard Billy Crystal did a great job.
Yeah, I mean, all the quotes that Muhammad Ali had, I mean, it's stuff of legend. He's known as the greatest for not just boxing, but for what he did for, you know, the African-American community and the civil rights movement and, you know, his stance on the wars. So.
Yeah, the Islamic community.
Right.
And that there's two things. Obviously, Ali was a great fighter. But what makes Ali so great is just how he stood up for what he believed in. That's really like what, you know the Bob Marley quote, like, stand up, get up, stand up for your right, you know? Ali, like, embodied that quote to a T. With the war, he had his belt stripped away from him, which is huge. That's what, you know, he's a boxer. That's what these guys live and breathe for. But there was something else that he stood up for on top of that.
And it was not the popular opinion at that time. In retrospect, he's a hero for it, but he got a lot of flack for it back then, and people considered him a draft dodger, and, you know, that's just not the way that... Luckily, that's not the way we remember him, because he was the greatest.
Yeah. There were a bunch of guys like that, too, actually. I know there were a couple. I forgot the names. But, listen, Ali was one of them who stood up for what he believed in. And the guy had legendary fights. Like, my dad always tells me about it. Ali Frazier 2, Ali Frazier 3, Ali Foreman. These are, like, boxing's not as big now. You know, the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, of course. But, like, it's nothing compared to what it was. And Ali just... created that whole boxing scene, and not to mention his quotes. It's amazing. I mean, I don't know about you, but I had like Ali posters all over my room growing up.
Oh yeah, I mean he's probably the most quotable athlete aside from like Yogi Berra.
Yeah, Yogi has some great quotes.
Yep.
I just want to go real quick. We got like a minute left. Who are your top five athletes of all time? Mine are probably Muhammad Ali, Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, Babe Ruth, and I go Jim Thorpe just because he was just a great Olympic athlete. Who would you go? And then Bob Gordie Howe's right there.
I would throw a golfer in there, probably Nicklaus or you know Woods when he was at the top of his game.
Right.
And then the Packer fan of me's got to go with Brett Favre because just he was such a gamer. Not really for his stats. And Peyton Manning.
Lovable guy, too.
Yep.
Kyle, thank you for coming on.
Absolutely.
Definitely,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely got to do it again soon. Big thank you to Adam Rubin from ESPNNewYork.com, Rob Cole, as always, the executive producer, and behind the glass, clicking all the buttons as the engineer of WGBB is Brian Graves. I think I'll be on. It's Sunday night, July 10th, so I'll be on back then. And everyone, have a great week. Have a great night. And, take care.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.